The following sermon was recorded during a weekly Sunday morning service at the First Unitarian Congregation of Ottawa. For more information about our congregation or to make a donation, please visit us online at www.firstunitarianottawa.ca.
For the purposes of getting to more interesting parts of this sermon, I'm going to assume that we can all agree that climate change is real. It's mostly caused by human consumption of fossil fuels, and it's happening right now. We also know that its effects are being felt throughout the world by all life on the planet, and that it threatens our collective survival as a species. We know this as a society at large. I know this in great detail. I remember my first year of environmental studies in 2006, the winter that Parliament Hill was completely green, when climate change was a hot topic in academia and the media. Surrounded by other like-minded students and professors, I felt sure that all this momentum was going somewhere, that we were on the cusp of decisive national and global action against climate change. As we all know, that didn't happen at all. I followed all of the disappointing political developments attentively, and yet, as Naomi Klein puts it, I was looking away. It was Bill McKibben's hard-hitting 2012 article called "Global Warming's Terrifying New Math" that temporarily brought me out of my despair and resignation. With some simple math, McKibben lays out the severity of climate change. He writes, "We have 5 times as much oil and coal and gas on the books," which means it's been discovered, "as climate scientists think is safe to burn. We'd have to keep 80% of those reserves locked away underground to avoid that fate. Before we knew these numbers, our fate had been likely. Now, barring some massive intervention, it seems certain." But even after reading the article, I was still looking away, because that massive intervention that he talks about seemed unattainable. I didn't understand what it would look like and how I could participate. Naomi Klein's excellent book, This Changes Everything, which I would highly recommend, reframes climate change as a social and economic issue more than a strictly environmental one. She argues that climate change is an inevitable product of our current economic and political system that has allowed fossil fuel companies to continue extracting without limits. It is a system where the quest for profit makes it perfectly acceptable to treat the Earth as a bottomless well of resources and its atmosphere as a dumping ground, and certain people as expendable. Without changing the system that creates and perpetuates the problem of climate change, how could we hope to solve this issue? So the massive intervention we need is a complete transformation of our global economy into one that puts the health of the Earth and its inhabitants first. That's all. Because changing the economic and political system would have many other implications, such as the distribution of wealth in an equal way, creating equality and justice for all people, it's not a very attractive solution for those in power. In order to avoid tackling the larger systemic issues, many other solutions to climate change have been proposed, and some have taken hold already. Credible and mostly not so credible scientists have proposed everything from blocking the sun with mirrors, to seeding the ocean with algae, to polluting the air with aerosols to create a permanent cooling haze. I'd say it is outside the scope of this sermon to discuss why these are all very bad ideas, but maybe you can just trust me on this. Pollution is not the solution to pollution. Others suggest that we need to work with the fossil fuel industry to transition slowly to clean energy while using increasingly risky and dirty sources of energy, or finding ways to make extraction more efficient. Or we need to focus on economic solutions like carbon tax and cap and trade. But none of these would achieve the necessary change in the very short window of time we have to transform our economy. And they would also uphold the current system that got us into this mess in the first place. The most popular way to act on climate change these days seems to be through consumerism. We have been convinced over the past 20 years or so that the best way to make change is by acting as individuals. Vote with your dollar. It just takes one person, and all you can do is change yourself, have become very common refrains. We have become resigned to the fact that large-scale change at the political and economic level is a pipe dream. And so we focus on what we have total control over, what we buy or don't buy. I will acknowledge that trying to create change through consumerism is attractive. It seems achievable and clean-cut, just a series of small, tangible actions that cumulatively have a big effect. If only all of us could consistently do many small things, changing ourselves and our lifestyle, together we would make a big enough difference. But the truth is that personal consumption is not actually very impactful. For example, municipal water consumption, so that's consumption from all of our households in Canada and the US, is about equal to golf course water consumption. And the US military is, by some accounts, the largest single consumer of petroleum in the world. Some experts say that household consumption accounts for as little as 10% of global consumption and waste production. So even if we all lived perfectly, which would be impossible, we would have no hope of making a very big dent in the problem of climate change. Derek Jensen's hard-hitting essay, Forget Shorter Showers, lays it all out in stark terms. He says, would any sane person think dumpster diving would have stopped Hitler, or that composting would have ended slavery, or brought about the 8-hour workday, or that dancing naked around a fire would have helped put in place the Civil Rights Act of 1964? Then why now, with all the world at stake, do so many people retreat into these entirely personal solutions? But he goes on to concede that, quote, part of the problem is that we've been the victims of a campaign of systematic misdirection. Consumer culture and the capitalist mindset have taught us to substitute acts of personal consumption or enlightenment for organized political resistance. By limiting ourselves to participation as shoppers, we are basically participating in the same economic system and often supporting the same big companies, though they may use different brand names, without diverting power to a new system. There are very important exceptions, of course, and I'll get to those later. Like all of you, I try to live as simply as possible. I shop minimally and carefully. I try to reduce my packaging and waste. I take short showers. I clean with baking soda and vinegar. I save twist ties, plastic bags, and containers, and jars, as my parents taught me to do. But what I've realized is that these actions do not make me an environmentalist or an activist. Changing my personal consumption is not a radical act. It is the very least I can and should be doing. As long as I live in a world where buying things is necessary, I will absolutely try to spend my money in less harmful ways. But I won't let this be my only cause or a distraction from the work of changing the economic and political systems that cause climate change. As Derek Jensen says, citizens have a much wider range of available resistance tactics, including voting, not voting, running for office, pamphleting, boycotting, organizing, lobbying, protesting, and when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we have the right to alter or abolish it. No social movement of the past has ever achieved a large-scale change through individual actions alone. Just think of abolitionism, civil rights, and feminism, to name a few. All successful movements have involved many, many people acting in many different ways, and often together. If we let ourselves be reduced to consumers, it's easy to become complacent and shy away from all the other ways that we are called to act together for change. Part of why Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, has been so influential for me and is very liberally used in this sermon is that she makes it clear what the solutions are and, most importantly, what they aren't, and who our friends are and political allies are and who they aren't. Bill McKibben has put it plainly that if fossil fuel companies fulfill their obligations to shareholders and deliver those profits gained from their planned extraction, we will exceed our carbon budget by so much that the climate will not be survivable. Our mission as ordinary people who live here is to save our atmosphere and continue existing on this planet. The mission of fossil fuel companies is to make profits in the short term, regardless of the environmental effects. These two goals are fundamentally incompatible. In his brilliant essay, The New Abolitionism, Christopher Hayes makes an interesting comparison between the movement to end fossil fuels and the movement to abolish slavery. The value of carbon reserves that would have to remain in the ground right now is about $10 trillion, which is comparable to the value of all slaves in the U.S. before abolition. At no other time in history has so much wealth been basically abandoned. Of course, slave owners would not have voluntarily given up such a profitable enterprise, and it was only after the American Civil War that slavery was finally made illegal. Though we know that the distribution of land, wealth, and power has remained fairly drawn along racial lines, and the wealth created by slavery has left a lasting legacy of white privilege. So, in some ways, the comparison between slavery and climate change is hopefully not accurate. I sincerely hope that the transition to a post-fossil fuel world doesn't involve violence and doesn't result in an economy where wealth is distributed in the same way as it is today. But the point is that abolition was a struggle between two sides with irreconcilable differences. There is no middle ground between slavery and abolition, just as there is no middle ground between the goals of fossil fuel companies and climate justice. One side must lose for the other to win. And in losing, they will have to give up the profits that they counted on. To quote Martin Luther King, Jr., "Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." So where is all this leading? The sermon, I mean, not climate change. We know that's not going anywhere good. I would not be preaching today if I had not found cause for hope, and indeed for the most hope I have ever felt for the future of this world. This is Naomi Klein again. She says, "The thing about a crisis this big this all-encompassing is that it changes everything. It changes what we can do, what we can hope for, what we can demand from ourselves and our leaders. It means there is a whole lot of stuff that we have been told is inevitable that simply cannot stand. And it means that a whole lot of stuff we have been told is impossible has to start happening right away. This is the exciting part. This is the thing that makes her book anything but the usual assessment of how dire climate change is. She effectively argues that climate change is the opportunity we have all been waiting for. It is a problem so huge that to solve it requires changing some fundamental aspects of the society we live in. And who among us hasn't wished for that kind of big change? I know that I have pursued many avenues of change, ultimately feeling that each was only a band-aid solution, dealing with a very small aspect of injustice. And even though I know I love farming, I know that systemic change is necessary in order for everyone to have access to good and healthy food. Of course, farming is important and impactful, and without it, we wouldn't have food. But without a change in our economic system, it's going to be really hard for farmers to make a living, and for many people to access the food we produce. Naomi Klein argues, as many climate justice activists have, that all struggles are climate justice struggles. That every person fighting for food security, affordable housing, better transit, reproductive justice, workers' rights, minimum guaranteed income, locally controlled energy, fair trade, and much more is working towards the same goal. I bet that would probably be everyone in this room. Climate justice encompasses all of these struggles because in order to combat climate change, we must change the whole system. And if we change the whole system, each of these smaller goals becomes more achievable, both part of the solution and a product of it. Realigning our values from profits to people and our collective home opens up so many exciting possibilities. For example, what if our priority as a society became to create a localized, sustainable food system that provides good, affordable food to everyone who needs it and pays small-scale, sustainable farmers a decent living wage so that they can stay in the business? A local food system is a step on the path to a post-carbon world. And it's also an inevitable consequence of a shift away from carbon. Without fossil fuels, the global transportation of food and production using petroleum-based fertilizers would just not be possible. Likewise, having a great accessible public transit system is a requirement for a post-carbon world, but it also helps us in that shift away from fossil fuels. The solution to each individual problem that may be considered unrelated to climate change is also an important step towards climate justice. Each solution would require economic and political change on a scale that we can hardly conceive of, though we may dream of it. The possibly good news is that no matter what happens, this change will come. It's just a question of when and how and at what cost. We could wait until peak oil arrives or the effects of climate change become so costly to the Western world, if we're being honest, that our leaders are forced to act. But I think we have a moral imperative to act now on several counts. In Ontario, we may not be feeling the worst effects of climate change yet, but that's not the case for most of the world. Extreme weather events are already happening around the world, and in each case, it is always the most vulnerable who suffer most. Effects are distributed, like wealth, unequally. There is also the question of intergenerational equity, our responsibility to leave the world in good shape for those that come after us. Not to mention our moral obligation to the global South to solve this problem, as members of the Western world that has put almost all of the carbon in the atmosphere. For at least those reasons, doing nothing is simply not an option for us. So what does doing something look like in Canada? Well, here's just one idea. As in much of the world, Indigenous people in Canada are on the front lines of fossil fuel development. From the proposed Northern Gateway pipeline in BC, to fracking in New Brunswick, to, of course, the Alberta tar sands, most extraction happens on or near Indigenous territories. They suffer most from the effects of this extraction. Another egregious wrong in the long, long list of the wrongs of colonialism. A number of First Nations have launched lawsuits in recent years to put a stop to current extraction projects on their land and to halt future exploration and development, including the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation and the Beaver Lake Cree Nation in Alberta. And there are dozens of lawsuits against the proposed Northern Gateway pipeline, making its construction a pretty remote possibility. Faced with continuing government inaction, these court cases might be the best shot we have of keeping carbon in the ground. In some cases, lands remain unceded, meaning that First Nations have never signed a treaty granting their use to anyone. Even on treaty lands, many fossil fuel projects violate the terms of the treaties, which specifically say that First Nations have rights to continue their way of life on the land. I'm guessing that open pit mines make hunting and fishing pretty tricky. This gives many First Nations a very strong case in court for being able to stop the extraction of fossil fuels, preventing climate change at its roots. But it doesn't seem right that after hundreds of years of colonization and the heavy toll that has come with it, these First Nations should be wholly responsible for stopping climate change through costly court battles, or even responsible at all. I see this issue as a tangible way that we can both tackle climate change and uphold our responsibility to Indigenous people. A campaign called Pull Together is raising money from across Canada to fund existing and future First Nations court cases against fossil fuel companies, and in some cases, our own government. I have donated what I could afford to this campaign and encourage you to look into it and do the same if you are able, or hold a fundraiser if that's something you can do. Others in Canada and the U.S. are offering financial support for First Nations green energy projects and small businesses that provide jobs and economic independence to these communities. I know that all of you are already participating in climate justice in many ways. You inspire me, and as you work in big and small ways to chip away at this huge problem and build up a different world. And that's the key, finding ways to tear down and recreate at the same time. Because action cannot be based on simply not doing things, not buying, not supporting, not investing in what is destructive. We must also be actively building a new world that simultaneously shifts us away from a fossil fuel-based economy and prepares us for a post-carbon world. I said I would revisit the issue of activist consumerism. One area where we can make a big difference with our dollar is in the food system. As I said before, the post-carbon world will be one of local food systems based on small-scale, sustainable food production. Creating the system requires a combination of opposition to what is bad and support of what is good, as do all issues with climate justice. Consider ways that you can foster this new food system, other than shopping at the farmers market, which is good too. Join a CSA, Community Shared Agriculture. Support the West End Well and other awesome co-ops. Give a farmer a personal loan or a grant to help with a new project. Push for changes in laws that would benefit farmers. Fight to ban pesticides that put pollinators at risk and jeopardize our food system. And support community food programs that help people access healthy local food. I think that if it hasn't already, climate change will cause each of us to reevaluate not only our way of life, but what we will be willing to do to protect our world. It is clear that those with money and power have no incentive to change voluntarily and will fight any attempt at a systematic overhaul. It is also clear that we only stand to lose by sticking with the system that we have, and we have so much to gain by taking a leap and trying to change everything. So how will each of us participate in the coming change? What will we risk? What comforts will we give up? With whom will we stand?